This is Jim Inkster. Today on Talk Louisiana, we will visit with LSU Mass Communication Professor Lynn Apkar, the Wendell Gray Switzer Endowed Chair, comments on his Solve the Budget project, which is inviting citizens to provide their input on cutting the Louisiana budget. Also, Professor Apkar, formerly with the New York Times, will discuss a tight congressional election in Pennsylvania and President Trump's continuing battle with the news media. Atchafalaya Basin keeper Dean Wilson is slated to be here to discuss the controversial Bayou Bridge pipeline project, and author Amy Kaufman on her book about what she terms America's guilty pleasure, the television show The Bachelor. Her book is Bachelor Nation, Inside the World of America's Favorite Guilty Pleasure. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. And locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Emails are welcome at talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Lynn Apkar. He's the Wendell Gray Switzer Endowed Chair for Media Literacy at Louisiana State University's Manship School of Mass Communication. Formerly with the New York Times, he spent 24 years with the newspaper of record in this country, the last job being the Page One editor before he arrived at LSU a couple of years ago. And he's here to talk about a few different matters, but it was almost a year ago on this show in our early days of the return of this program to WRKF that we had Lynn Apkar and Peter Kovacs and Mark Ballard on, and they were discussing this Solve the Budget project. And since that plan was unveiled, listeners and citizens have provided lots of ideas on how to solve the Louisiana budget, about 9,000 of them. And you have sifted through the ideas and insights, and it's an interesting group of people, isn't it?
It is interesting, and there's a stark difference between last year's budget problems and the set of questions we asked when we launched in 2017 versus this year. The biggest difference is that Louisianans who have taken this, and this is an unscientific poll, we make no pretense that this is anything but a straw poll. People it's self-selecting, they go up to it. But this year, people think that taxes are something you can't get around, and it's very difficult to solve this particular deficit problem without taxes. We don't advocate that. We are nonpartisan, but that's what the results are showing.
But nonetheless, at this point, many lawmakers are averse to this.
They are averse to it, and there probably is a way to get around it, but they're going to have to think in a broader context than what they are now. Most Louisianans don't understand what one of the most complicated budgets in the country. So much of what Louisiana spends is locked up or committed by law or by the Constitution. And what is left to fight about is really a third of a third. And inevitably, it involves higher education and health care. That's why we're hearing so much about cuts to the university systems and to Medicaid and other kinds of health programs.
877-217-5757 is your number, and taxes are not welcome by anybody, but in Louisiana, like in other red states, the taxes are a bad word, and we've had people like Senator John Kennedy, who was treasurer for many years, say that we should not impose any more taxes on our citizens, that there are ample ways to cut the budget. Yesterday, Jay Darden, the Commissioner of Administration, a former state lawmaker, former lieutenant governor and secretary of state, says there's no way to do this without hammering away at higher ed and health care in particular. So there is a difference of opinion. And right now it appears, Lynn, that based on your responses from people who are going to solve the budget project that you're involved with, that many are in favor of raising taxes, but in Louisiana, it takes two-thirds support to do that. And that's a tough, tough lift when you're a Democratic governor dealing with a Republican legislature.
It is, and we saw what happened with the special session earlier this month. I actually think, as a newcomer to the state, that the state's going to have to think more broadly. And I thought that 2 years ago when the legislature convened again in a special session to try to fix the deficit then, that when they appointed a special task force, a blue ribbon panel, to look at broad restructurings, changes, an overhaul, essentially, of the state's tax system, I was optimistic, naively, that this would be a starting point for the legislature, the government, and the people of Louisiana to think about how they raise revenue. But it wasn't. It's an excellent report, but it basically just died on arrival, and for reasons that I, you know, are beyond me. They're far above my pay grade as an analyst and a newcomer to the state. They just didn't go far enough, even though I think they didn't go anywhere. I think there were good ideas there, but they didn't go anywhere.
For those unfamiliar with the mechanics of this, how do people who respond to the solve the budget questions get involved in this process?
It's really easy, Jim. It's solvethebudget.com or solvethebudget.org. Our partner is The Advocate at advocate.com, which, by the way, as a newcomer journalist to this state, I think The Advocate does a terrific job here on a number of levels. But in any case, they are our partner at this. It's on their website. And you go to The Advocate or just go to solvethebudget.com. It takes you right to The Advocate section of the site on this. And there are, you know, about three dozen questions. It's fairly quick. They're yes-no questions. And as you click along, yes, I want to raise this. Yes, I want to cut that. Yes, I want to cut this. No, I don't want to cut that. You see what the value is for each cut and how much or how little it widens narrows the so-called fiscal cliff, the deficit. And after you're done, you can submit it and see how you did. You can also see how other people did. We ask you a few very basic demographic questions, age and ethnicity. And then you can go and see a spreadsheet that shows how people did it. We make, again, no case that this is a scientific, weighted, measured poll in any way. We are just saying to people, here is an educational tool about the state's budget. That's really our mission. That's my mission as the media literacy chair at Manship. That's really the school's mission. We like to think of ourselves, or we have positioned ourselves over the decades, as a journalism school in public affairs. And this is a public affairs problem, and it's a way to educate the people about the state's number one issue.
Are there any areas where people are in favor of cutting?
There are cuts, and the cuts are pretty interesting, actually. There is not a lot of support for some educational systems budgets, particularly the community and technical college system, which I think is a big mistake. Also probably would be in favor of cutting some other smaller various general spending accounts, such as here's one here. Funding for senior centers would surprise me. It was a supplemental fund, but not very much money, but there are some cases where people don't want to do that. Cancel repairs at a juvenile justice detention center in Bridge City, Columbia, and Swanson. There's people think, they would.
And what kind of taxes are people in favor of?
Well, this is, this may be because this is the only way to close the deficit. They are in favor of a gas tax. No, I'm saying that wrong. I'm sorry. They're in favor of the quarter penny, which was debated during the special session, and they're in favor of holding on to the fifth penny.
Just keeping it in place?
Yes.
Well, that right now is not even on the table because the governor and the legislature
are opposed to it.
But the people who have responded to this, and as you have noted, this is far from a scientific poll, but the people who have responded to it said, look, I guess we're living life as We are with five pennies, so why not keep it as is? But that's not on the table at this point.
It isn't. Neither is tobacco tax this session, but
people are in favor.
People are overwhelmingly
We still have a very low tobacco tax relative to other states.
And we raised it 2 years ago, last year, actually. And
still about $4 behind New York, though.
We are.
Per pack.
Per pack, yep. But overwhelmingly, that tax gets a lot of support. We didn't want to limit ourselves just to proposals that were on the table. We wanted to see what people thought. So we asked about the movie credit issue. That was cut back significantly in the last legislature or two. The question is, do we cut it back even more, phase it out? And generally, there is a support for phasing it out.
877-217-5757 for Lynn Apkar, the Wendell Gray Switzer Endowed Chair of Media Literacy at LSU's Manship School, also a WRKF board member. And we're going to talk to Lynn about what's going on in our country. And right now, it looks like, it doesn't look like, it is a razor-tight election in Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh area, in which Democrat Connor Lamb may have pulled off an upset over the Republican Rick Saccone. President Trump came to Pittsburgh over the weekend, Saturday night, and spent 75 minutes on a podium, including some remarks, not many, but some, in favor of the Republican and attacking the Democrat. But President Trump, who carried this district by 20 percentage points 17 months ago, has not had the coattails, it appears, that will bring Rick Saccone across the finish line. We'll talk about that and more with Lynn Apkar, your number 877-217-5757, back after this time. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 for Lynn Apkar. 24 years he was with the New York Times. His last job there was the page one editor. Came to LSU a few years ago. He's a professor at the Manship School, and he's here to talk about any matter you desire. Solve the budget or nationally, of course, there's much going on in our world. 877-217-5757. Steve in Lafayette. Steve, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Professor, what would you recommend as the best way to engage with the media in my parish? I've found that in certain elements that have happened, certain events that have happened in the parish in the not too recent past, the media has not really gotten it. There was a case where there was a swastika painted on a bridge in a fairly prominent location, and the media just didn't get it. They were not engaging the community. So I'm wondering, how can I engage the media?
Thanks for calling. When you say that media is not getting it, they did not cover it?
Did they not cover it, or just didn't cover it properly?
They didn't cover it properly or sufficiently, in my humble opinion.
Can you elaborate a little bit? What was the problem?
There were misspellings. Ooh. They didn't reach out to the Jewish community, small as it is here. They didn't reach out to any religious community. And it didn't seem like they got quotes from anybody vis-a-vis the activities other than the police who were investigating.
All right.
Well, I can't speak for the papers and the websites in Lafayette. I think they on the whole do a pretty good job. But that sounds like a miss. They should be talking to people. People, period, whether they're religious groups or others who would naturally take offense at this. And I suppose, they probably were more focused on who might have done it and the police investigation. And that's a piece of the story, but not the whole story.
Thank you, Steve. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. For Lynn Apkar, who'll be with us for a few more minutes, and he has a long career in journalism at the highest level of American journalism, the New York Times. And the president has been calling it the failing New York Times. The president is a man who has changed American discourse, and he fired his top cabinet member, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, yesterday by tweet. Fired him by tweet. What's going on?
Well, there's been so much analysis over the last 24 hours. I mean, you could kind of tell that they were two men cut from a totally different background. Trump is an entrepreneur. He has a personality that shoots from the hip. Rex Tillerson was a product of corporate America, an engineer really by training. I never thought that this was a match that was going to succeed. And many people now are saying that it was on the rocks almost from the beginning, probably should have happened several months ago. Trump delayed for whatever reason. Some people think he was talked out of it, as he's often talked out of various impulses that he has, which is probably a good thing. Who knows how many things he's been talked out of that we don't know. It was a difficult relationship from the beginning. It was fraught with comments like "Don't waste your time negotiating," and now they actually are. It turns out that the deal with the agreement to sit down in some way and have a conversation with North Korea, whether it's face to face or otherwise, was agreed to without the Secretary of State's knowledge.
877-217-5757. We're going to go to the phone lines with Lynn Apkar. And when Donald Trump left his first wife for his second wife many years ago, the New York Post had a headline that from Marla Maples, his second wife, referring to Donald Trump. The headline read, "Best sex I ever had." Today's New York Post headline is, "Worst Rex he ever had." Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Ms. Apkar, did the Wall Street lobbyists control the Republicans in the New York legislature like the big oil lobbyists have the Louisiana Republicans in their back pocket?
Did the Wall Street lobbyists, in other words, lobbyists for the big investment houses and the banks,
yes,
control the state legislature? I think they play a big role. I think they do play a big role, but they play a big role in a lot of ways. And one of the things that always bothers me is that the parties let them play it. One of the great jokes of Washington is if you go to the House Financial Services Committee, there's hardly room for a chair for the public to sit in because there's so many lawmakers on that committee because they want to pick up the PAC money.
Q on airline. Hi, Q. You're on the air with Professor Apkar. Hi, Q.
Hi. Yes, I'm here. I was wondering if after watching all of these special elections that have gone on in Alabama and last night Pennsylvania, I was watching that up down to the last wire and everywhere else around where the Democrats are actually winning. I'm wondering if you all or anybody else might think that a Democrat might win in Louisiana. I would hate for us to be the state that would be behind in that matter on the wrong side of history, but seeing all of these grassroots movements, I'm getting a little bit more and more excited about that possibility.
Oh, there's so many variables that you can't predict. John Bel Edwards proved a Democrat can win. He had an interesting race because he had an opponent who was unexpectedly weak. And weakened as the campaign went on. Everybody thought it was a long shot for him when he started, and it became such a surprising victory that a very good book, was written about the campaign. So I would not give up hope. I don't think this is a two-party state by any means, but I do think that in certain cases, in certain places, Democrats can win.
Well, we're going to see a lively governor's election next year, Q, between Democrat John Bel Edwards and a Republican. The most likely challenger appears to be U.S. Senator John Neely Kennedy, who Neil in Little Rock a few days ago wrote to us by email saying the most dangerous place in America is to get between John Kennedy and a television camera. But John Kennedy has not said a word, unkind word, about the president, who is accused of any number of things, including consorting with a Baton Rouge native, Stephanie Clifford, pride of Scotlandville Magnet High School class of 97, whose birthday is Saturday, by the way, number 39, a porn star who got $130,000 from President Trump's lawyer to not talk about her relationship with the president, something the president did not address the other night in Pittsburgh. But he did go after Chuck Todd, the host of Meet the Press. Here's President Trump talking about Chuck Todd.
You ever see the story where it's 1999, I'm on Meet the Press, a show now headed by Sleepy Eyes Chuck Todd. He's a sleeping son of a bitch, I'll tell you.
All right. He's tough. He's tough. He also said of Oprah Winfrey that if she ran, he, quote, knows her weakness, Lynn. He said it like three times. I know her weakness.
Well, I bet he does. You know, he was very effective in the primaries at demolishing his opponents. He did it by name calling. He got at some of their weaknesses, and he was successful at it. And he, whenever I think he wants to feel better about his presidency and himself, he goes out on the road and gives one of these campaign style rallies as a public appearance of the president, just like he did over the weekend. You know, they seem to work for him. It energizes him. It connects him with his base. The base is still with him, more so than ever. And it helps, I think it helps kind of soothe him in ways that he thinks he's having a successful presidency.
Well, he's a branding master. When I see Ted Cruz, the words Lying Ted go through my
low energy mind. Marco.
Yeah,
and low energy Marco. And
Pocahontas.
No, Little Marco and Low Energy Jeb.
Yeah. Thank you, Lynn Apkar. Coming next, Dean Wilson, the Atchafalian Basin Keeper on the Bayou Bridge Project. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address. And our producers today, Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill. In studio now, Dean Wilson, he's the Atchafalaya Basin Keeper, and the staff attorney, Misha Mitchell, is also with us, and they're here to talk about the Bayou Bridge Project, which continues to be controversial, and federal judge Shelley Dick of Baton Rouge has issued an order that has stopped the project that spans from one end of the state to the other through South Louisiana, at least a portion of the project, and this is a something that is ongoing as far as arguments over whether this pipeline is a great thing that will spur economic growth in Louisiana or a bad thing which will destroy the pristine environment that we know as the Atchafalaya Basin. Dean Wilson, let's begin with you. What are your thoughts about the Bayou Bridge Project?
Okay, the main thing I think people need to understand, it is first the importance of the Atchafalaya Basin. The Atchafalaya Basin, for one thing, is protecting us from river floods, Mississippi River floods. It's a spillway. So it's protecting the city of Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Lafayette, much of the Mississippi River Valley, millions of people. And the situation we have with pipelines is there is not enforcement by the Corps of Engineers. The Corps don't have a single person reviewing permits for compliance. Those corridors, the pipelines we already have in the basin, they are out of compliance with the permit. So we don't have nothing against the oil companies or oil development or pipelines per se, but our problem is that those pipelines are devastating the Atchafalaya Basin. It's a conduit for sediments into the swamps. As the basin fills up with sediments, it's like a bathtub filling up with dirt. It's losing the ability to protect from flood. So we're losing the basin, you know, and part of it is because of these pipelines. So our argument here is the Corps is arbitrary and capricious on granting permits that on corridors, they are out of compliance. To companies, they are out of compliance with permits. And grant permits that they don't intend to enforce.
Well, do you think it's going to jeopardize the environment?
Oh, yes. You have a corridor that's out of compliance. So those corridors, what they do is a canal with a spoil bank, a levee, you know, like, you know, going east to west. The water is going north to south. And the corridor is out of compliance. So what happens is you put more pipes, you make it harder and harder to restore, you know, those corridors. And the situation is that citizens don't have the legal powers to enforce those permits. So while those pipelines are there and there's no enforcement, we're stuck with it. So we have decades of permit after permit with no enforcement. and is devastating the Chafalaya Basin.
Well, last month, federal judge Shelley Dick ordered that work within the Atchafalaya Basin must stop until the suit is decided, but she allowed work to continue outside the Swamp Basin, and Bayou Bridge has appealed that ruling, and right now it's ongoing in the court system, and representing the group that Dean Wilson is involved with, he's been the Atchafalaya Basin keeper for 14 years, is Misha Mitchell, and she is with Dean in studio with us. Misha, your thoughts about where the legal wrangling is right now.
Yes, thanks, Jim. Where we are now in the case is we are defending our injunction in the Fifth Circuit, and we are hopeful that Judge Dick's ruling will stand. She has recognized that the pipeline will result in irreparable harm to the basin, and we are just hopeful that we will continue to get to the meat of the case, which really revolves around what Dean has already alluded to, the issue of noncompliance with former permits and lack of enforcement by the Army Corps of Engineers. So that's really what we're trying to shed some light on with this case.
It's a 165-mile-long pipeline, I believe, going from Cameron Parish to St. James Parish. How long has this been in the works?
Well, the final permits were issued to the company at the end of the year. So last December, they received their Section 404 permit from the Corps, and construction began pretty quickly after that, and I would say January of this year.
877-217-5757 or locally 297-5633 if you'd like to join Dean Wilson and Misha Mitchell. And we've had representatives from both sides of this issue, from industry and Dean, the people who are on the other side believe this will spur economic growth and that it's not going to do anything more than what has already been done to the environment in Louisiana. And obviously, there has been great damage done to the environment through the years by industry. But what's one more pipeline going to do?
Well, it is not only about one more pipeline. It is enough is enough. You know, those pipeline companies and all companies had devastated the coast, had devastated the Atchafalaya Basin. You know, it's putting in jeopardy the ability of humans to survive in coastal Louisiana. So, you know, you have to come up, you know, the only time that we have to challenge things is during the permit process because we cannot enforce those permits. So, you know, we just put our foot on the ground and say, no, you cannot grant more permits until you start enforcing.
Well, Misha, there are those who say, look, that there has been great advancement in technology, that we, like it or not, we live in an environment that's dependent upon the oil and gas industry and that this has to be part of our life as we know it if we are to advance as a state. Your thoughts?
Well, we recognize the reality that oil and gas is a major part of the economy in Louisiana, but also a major part of the economy and the culture is the value that the basin brings to the state and to the nation as a whole. And part of that is the interests of the fisheries and the crawfishermen who live in the basin, who have been working and making a livelihood in the basin, excuse me, for hundreds of years. So the interests of this economic group should not be stymied by the oil and gas industry. I believe that there's a place for everyone at the table, and we just want to make sure that our voice is heard.
877-217-5757. Dan Collins calling from Mid-City. Dan's been a guest with us before. He was involved in his own dispute involving a project in the Atchafalaya. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Jim, first I'd like to commend Dean Wilson for dedicating his life to protecting the Atchafalaya Basin. It's one of the country's largest freshwater swamp. If we didn't have people like Dean Wilson, all right, we wouldn't have an Atchafalaya Basin. I'd also like to say that I commend Judge Shelley Dick for what she did. She followed the law, Jim. One of the issues that we have in this particular case is mitigation. And in my case, we saw the state not mitigate the Bayou Postillion project.
All right, well, what's your question for Dean and Misha?
At this point,
How many days does it look like we're going to be before there is a ruling? And what was y'all's feel about the event that took place yesterday?
All right. Yesterday there was a hearing, and what's your take about how long this will take?
Well, honestly, I'm not entirely sure. We hope that the court will rule quickly, so perhaps a ruling will come out today. And we're pleased that the court was focused on the issue of mitigation, and that was a primary concern that was raised in the oral arguments yesterday. So we're hopeful, but again, we're not entirely sure. We'll see what the court rules, and hopefully that will come quickly.
Judy, en route to the Atchafalaya Basin. Judy on the road. Good morning to you. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dean Wilson and Misha Mitchell. Hi, Judy.
It's Jody, Jim. Jody Mish.
Okay. Jody,
we know
Jody, who's been involved like Dean in this issue. And you were about to say your title.
Right. I'm the president of the Louisiana Crawfish Producers Association, West, Jim, and also a party to the suit. I'm also on the Atchafalaya Basin Levy District. I'm a levy commissioner for St. Martin Parish. I'm the vice chairman of the Louisiana Crawfish Promotion and Research Board. I've been on there for about 20 years, and I'm an elected town councilman for town of Henderson. I'm serving my fourth four-year term.
a lot of titles.
Right, a lot of stuff I'm involved in. But comments about the economic issues and the economic impact of this pipeline potentially having on Louisiana. This pipeline, when it's going to be complete, is going to produce 12 permanent jobs. That's from the Energy Transfer Partners people themselves at hearings we've attended, okay? These jobs that are on standby right now because of this preliminary injunction, they're all temporary jobs. They're going to last for a very short period of time, and then those jobs are over with. What I want the people to understand is over the years of these pipelines impacting the Atchafalaya Basin in such a negative way, just in St. Martin Parish alone, a few decades ago, we used to produce more crawfish than sugar produced in St. Martin Parish. I mean, when the fishermen out in the Atchafalaya Basin in full force, we produce hundreds of millions of pounds of crawfish that hits the Louisiana economy. Imagine the impact that that has, Jim, on the Louisiana economy.
All right,
economy.
So are you saying that is in jeopardy if this project is completed?
Well, it only adds to the problem that we already have. These fall banks crippled the Atchafalaya Basin as far as killing our water flow to where the fishery doesn't have a good oxygen level in the water and where we have a lot of fish kills, crawfish die in the crawfish traps. It fills up the bottom that we've been fishing for so many decades. The bottoms are filling up to the point with sand to where you no longer have areas that you can fish anymore.
All right, Jody, thank you. Jody, he's involved as the Crawfish Producers president, and you're out there on the front lines with him, Dean. Is there great concern in the environmental community about this project?
Yes, of course it is, and it's not only about this project. You know, what we are challenging, the reason we're challenging this permit is because the accumulative effects of decades of all development, and you need to stop because we're losing, you know, thousands of jobs. Permanent jobs. You know what happened? We cannot put all the eggs in one basket. What's going to happen when the oil industry is gone? Well, those jobs ain't going to be there no more because the basin, it won't be there no more for them. You know, so we're talking about permanent jobs, you know.
Well, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. Dean Wilson and Misha Mitchell, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay, thank you.
We're back after this time out with Amy Kaufman, author of Bachelor Nation. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest at this time is Amy Kaufman. She's a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She's covered film, celebrity, and pop culture since 2009. And on the beach, she reports from industry events like the Academy Awards, the Sundance Film Festival, and the Grammys. Her book is Bachelor Nation, Inside the World of America's Favorite Guilty Pleasure. Good morning, Amy Kaufman.
Good morning.
It's nice to hear your voice, and this is a story that is amazing in this day and age, and you, of course, have been on the front lines of breaking stories about sexual assault allegations against some famous men in Hollywood, including James Franco and Brett Ratner and Russell Simmons, and this book is about a different kind of thing in Hollywood, and it is amazing that it has a life of its own, not only in California, but across the country for 16 years in a row. A man watched 30 eligible young women step out of a string of limousines ready to do anything to win his heart and a diamond ring. How do you explain
this? How do I explain the fascination? Well, you know, I think that even though it's completely outlandish to compete with 25 to 30 other women for the affection of a supposedly eligible bachelor, you know, when we watch it, fundamentally, we're all just comparing ourselves to people in situations that we have been in more or less. You know, we've all dated, we've all fallen in love or imagined that we could be with a guy who would sweep us off our feet in that way. And so I think that that is really what keeps us watching in a different way than shows in reality television like Survivor, where, you know, we don't all know how to try to build a fire, or on Top Chef, we're not all gourmet chefs. But when it comes to love on The Bachelor, we're all judge and jury from our couch.
Well, you say, Amy, there's a rigorous casting and auditioning process. It is an extensive evaluation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly extensive. You get to the final round of auditions. You have to go to L.A. and complete a 150-question survey. You have to be interviewed by a psychologist, meet with all these producers. You have to do blood and urine tests. PI looks into your background to see if you have any, you know, criminal charges. And so before you get on there, they really know a lot about you and exactly how they're going to be able to push your buttons when production gets underway.
Well, what is it that propels these young women to participate in this kind of thing?
I mean, I think it's a mix. You know, a lot of the women I spoke to saw it as sort of a free trip, a free adventure. You get to go to a few exotic locations, and if it works out with the guy, that's just sort of an added benefit. But also now, in 2018, of course, with social media, women who go on the show and men are getting tens of thousands of new followers on Instagram and Twitter, and so they become sort of quote-unquote influencers. They get to sell, you know, Fit Tea and gummy bears that make your hair grow longer and all this stuff, and get paid thousands of dollars to post ads. And so it's like a whole new lucrative career path as well.
The estate in Malibu that serves as the Bachelor Mansion, what is it like?
Well, I was going to go check it out for myself, but the owner of the mansion, because the ABC doesn't actually own it, it's like a guy who lives there with his family when production's not underway. He was going to tour me around, but when he asked ABC if they would if that was okay, they told me no, because I'm sort of on the outs with the production. And so as far as I know, though, it's this very extensive mansion in Agoura Hills, California, which is sort of near where the Kardashians live. And like I said, a guy lives there with his family for most of the year. And then when the production comes in, he has to get all of his furniture trucked out, and they go, like, decamp to a hotel for a few weeks.
Amy, you describe what you call the brutal world of producer manipulation. How does this work?
The producers become real confidants to contestants during this process because the contestants are in what they call the bubble. You know, they don't have access to the outside world via the internet or phone, no news, no books. There's an open bar. They have no friends or family. Everyone they meet on the show is also competing for the same guy. And the producers are there in their ear to tell them how great this guy is and how emotionally vulnerable they should be in competing for him. And so, you know, you come to trust people and you sort of forget that these producers are also tasked with just making an entertaining television show and maybe don't always have your best interests at heart.
Well, there have been other shows that have preceded this. Many of us are old enough to remember The Dating Game, and there was Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire. Why has The Bachelor had a life of its own, and these others, particularly The Dating Game, lasted for many years, but this one has literally taken the cake as far as these kinds of productions?
Yeah, when you mentioned Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, and that was the first big show that the creator of The Bachelor ever made. So that was this pageant in Las Vegas where 50 women showed up to compete for a supposed millionaire and then marry him live on air. And it turned out like the guy wasn't even actually a millionaire and had a restraining order out against him by his ex. That was a disaster. But Mike Fleiss has said that he thinks The Bachelor is different than these other shows because it's less cynical. While that two-hour special, Multimillionaire special, was maybe just so voyeuristic and outlandish, The Bachelor really upped the romance and added sort of a quote-unquote sincerity factor that I think viewers responded to because it felt like they could get invested in the couple and that they could imagine themselves more easily in that scenario than just like a two-hour courtship. At least this one was 8 weeks, which is still nuts.
The book is Bachelor Nation, Inside The World of America's Favorite Guilty Pleasure from Amy Kaufman, who lives in Los Angeles, and her reporting for the LA Times has coincided with her enjoyment of The Bachelor, particularly when you reported on the sexual assault accusations against The Bachelor in Paradise last summer. That was quite a turn of events.
Yeah, this was a situation where two contestants engaged in sexual activity, and after the fact, producers basically blew a whistle and said what had happened was not above board, and so production shut down. They did a whole investigation, and it all centered around questions of consent, because alcohol is so prevalent on the show. If people are drinking and get to a point where they're even blacked out and then are engaging in sexual activity, how aware are they of what they are doing on camera?
As I mentioned, you have been at the forefront of reporting on some of these men, famous men, who have done bad things to women. And this is a show that reportedly even tracks the female contestants' menstrual cycles. Is it denigrating to women?
I mean, a lot of people have been asking me, you know, do you see a correlation between the Me Too movement and The Bachelor, or how can The Bachelor continue to exist in the midst of the Me Too movement? And, you know, I do think there are some questions that are important to explore about that. But at the same time, you know, The Bachelor, these women are there, even though we don't necessarily understand why they would sign up. They're there of their own volition, right? And in the stories I write about, in terms of, you know, Hollywood predators, these people are engaging in non-consensual behavior where, you know, they're harassing women and it's completely unwanted. So I don't necessarily see too many parallels between the two situations.
Now, you have tracked these couples through the years, and most of them are not together, but there are a few success stories.
Yeah, there are. And of course, the franchise loves to point to, you know, Tristan Ryan, the original Bachelorette, who is still married to the guy she picked, a firefighter, and they live in Vail with their two kids. You know, there are a few success stories, but I think it's all about making it work is based more on asking the right questions in that short amount of time you have on the show. You know, are you really thinking about if you want to move to an entirely different city with the person you choose, and how do you want to raise your kids, and, you know, what do you share the same religious beliefs, and what other how do your ethics and morals line up? You know, those are the things you need to be exploring if you want to make sure it's going to last beyond the after the final rose.
Well, you have reported like nobody else on the ongoing social experiment that is The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. Where is this going? Is this going to evolve into something else?
I don't know. It hasn't changed that much since 2002, which is, like, kind of alarming. I mean, the fact that they only cast the first Black Bachelorette last year is still disturbing to me. You know, I hope that they continue to diversify and that we see a range of not only, you know, ethnicities, but body types. You know, we always see, like, either these really muscular jack guys or these very thin women with long hair and all this. It's like, let's change it up, guys. We need to see a range of people on television.
Have you watched it since the start?
I haven't watched it since the very start, but, you know, pretty early on, I got hooked in after, as I got a little bit older and I sort of, like, had my foot in the dating world, I think I had more of a point of comparison for watching it.
Mm-hmm. And you, in the book, have some candid conversations with some famous celebrities who are hooked on it.
Yeah, you know, I've seen so many celebrities go on late night shows and sort of like gleefully or shamefully admit that they were fans of The Bachelor. And so when I was reaching out to people to talk about why everyone was so obsessed with this, I thought, you know, why not get the perspective of some of those same fans? And so I did speak to, you know, people like Amy Schumer and Diablo Cody and Donnie Wahlberg, and they all had really fun perspectives on why we're so addicted to the show, which, of course, aren't that different from, I think, the reasons we all feel so enticed by this show. Schumer said that she looks forward to nothing more every week than watching The Bachelor, and yet she feels like it, she said, effed, but, you know, really messed up to watch it. And so I think she sort of was speaking to the mixed feelings we have about tuning in every week, even though we are so addicted to it.
It is a thorough book. You even go into the editing technique dubbed Frankenbiting. What is Frankenbiting?
Yeah, so Frankenbiting, as you might guess, comes from the word Frankenstein, so sort of alluding to something that's all mashed together. Basically, it's when you take a soundbite and you alter the meaning of it by editing the actual soundbite. For example, if I were to say, I really don't see myself getting married to Ari, they might change that to, I really see myself getting married to Ari, and play B-roll over that soundbite instead of you actually seeing my mouth moving, so that it seemed like I was saying something with a different meaning than I actually was.
Well, the book is received much praise, and for good reason, The Bachelor Nation, Inside the World of America's Favorite Guilty Pleasure. Thank you, Amy Kaufman. And thank you for joining us today. Democrat Connor Lamb is the apparent winner of a House seat in Pennsylvania's Trump country by a razor-thin margin. We'll be talking about that tomorrow. Until then, for Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.